Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good afternoon, everyone. First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and supporting your locally owned and independent businesses. I am pleased to introduce author and film director John Sayles. John has been called the do-it-yourselfer in both film and literature. His first three movies, including my favorite, Brother from Another Planet, were homemade and recently restored by the UCLA Film and Television Archive. And this very book tour he is on, he and his partner turned into a good old-fashioned road trip across the country. And not a lot of people have the ambition to do that, so it is. He's the do-it-yourselfer. John has been nominated for the National Book Award, two Academy Awards, and he's received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Writers Guild of America, John Steinbeck Award, and more. He's directed 17 featured films, written numerous novels and screenplays, and today he is here presenting his newest book, A Moment in the Sun. So without further ado, please join me in giving a warm welcome to John Sayles.
Thank you.
So, Moment in the Sun takes place between 1897 and about 1903, and is about most of what went on in those years. And some of it actually, a couple chapters happened here in Denver, so I figured I'd read you some of one of those. In 1898, the United States had declared war against the Spanish, hoping to chase them out of Cuba. And because the standing army at that time was very small, almost every state raised a volunteer regiment to have enough troops to go down to Cuba and, boot the Spanish out and save the poor Cuban people. One of my main characters, a guy named Hod Brackenridge, who's a former hard rock miner, who's already had a series of misadventures in the book. He's been up in the Yukon and didn't find any gold. In fact, lost all his goods up there, fell under the influence and started working for the notorious con man Soapy Smith, began to be in prize fights that Soapy Smith and his kind of ne'er-do-well southern assistant, Niles Manigault, arranged, and he's managed to kill somebody in the ring in Alaska, and so is basically on the lam, working his way across the country in menial jobs. The last time we saw him in the book was in Leadville, Colorado, where he was arrested for hopping a freight with basically his only friend in the world, an Ojibwe Indian guy named Big Ten. And because he had mining experience, he was allowed to go work in the mines for a while, and while Big Ten was taken away to jail, so he hasn't seen him for a while. And when it was discovered what his real name was, he was kicked out of the mine, and in desperation, he runs into Niles Manigault again and has agreed to be in another prize fight. And so he's been brought to Denver for the arrangements for the prize fight. A couple things, people who will be mentioned in this who are locally notable. The Harry you hear mentioned is Harry Tammen, who with Frank Bonfils ran the Denver Post and was quite a showman. And the Otto you hear mentioned was a guy named Otto Floto, who was a great big fat guy who was hired by Harry Tammen mostly because he loved his name. He was made a sports writer, which he turned out to be pretty good at. But he later, Harry Tammen, loved circuses and bought a circus and named it the Otto Floto Circus. So there's still a Floto Circus, usually with another circus joined with it, traveling around the world. And Otto Floto was also famous in Colorado because as a younger man, he and a prostitute managed to start a fire that burned down half of Cripple Creek, starting with the Red Light District. Volunteers. In Denver, they don't make hot undress. The meeting is in the bigger bar downstairs at the Windsor, the one with the silver dollars inlaid every few feet in the floor and walls. Masterson, perched on a stool pulled away from the bar counter, as the pencil artist sits and stands and squats to draw his face from different vantage points. Niles Manigault obligingly skittering out of the eyeline whenever it changes, and the fat man, Floto, blocking most all the daylight from the open doorway. "You know the deal?" asked Masterson, flicking his eyes briefly at Hod.
"He fought Kowinski," says Niles. "Held his own."
"The three great virtues of a prize fighter," says Masterson, lifting his chin a bit to catch the light angling in from Larimer Street, "are talent, heart, and obedience. In my book, the last of these is the greatest."
"He's a sharp boy," says Niles. "Once the deal, whatever it is, has been agreed upon."
12 rounds, says the fat man, slowly circling Hod, poking his bicep once with his cane. "Ready needs time to sell beer. And if the kid and Mungone are fighting straight, for 8 rounds they're fighting so that they both stay on their feet," interrupts Masterson. "Then they can knock each other's brains out."
"So you place some wages?"
"Move, Otto," says Masterson, holding his pose and wiggling a finger sideways. "You're throwing a shadow." The fat man snorts in annoyance, but moves to the side a few feet. He wears a bright check suit and a red vest. "If you just have a photograph taken like a normal man..."
"It lacks the human dimension," says Masterson.
His face is fleshier than Hod had imagined, his eyes sharper. In their boyhood games, he always insisted on being Masterson, and his brother Zeb left with a choice of bad men to represent.
"It lacks soul. These likenesses, drawn, which will appear in... what's this one to be called?"
"Bat Masterson, Plague of the Kansas Outlaw," answers the crouching artist, eyes fixed on his sketchpad.
"These likenesses convey the spirit of the man, his sense of vitality. A photograph freezes time. Character becomes a mask, motion a blur."
"What about the moving pictures?"
"Overrated."
Hod catches the eye of Niles Manigault, who discreetly motions for him to sit back at the bar. He wonders what they do to keep men like himself, desperate men, from prying the silver dollars out of the woodwork.
"They could have used one of those cameras in San Francisco when your friend Earp handed the fight to Sharkey," says Floto. "The man fouled. Fitz had him all but knocked out on a punch delivered when Tom's knees were on the canvas. A film wouldn't have lied. Were you there?"
The fat man pushes the skimmer back on his head.
"No, but if there'd been a camera, I was there, and the correct decision was made."
The artist clears his throat. "Do you think..." he asked softly, "you could assume a gunfighting stance?"
"About to draw or piece in hand?"
"Either one would suit me." The hero of Adobe Wells stands and pulls a short-barreled Colt from inside his jacket. The fat man takes a step backward.
"That isn't loaded, is it?" "What fucking use under God's blue firmament would it do to carry a unloaded firearm?"
Hod looks down to the end of the bar. A large man has folded his arms on the counter and is dozing upon them. Horace Tabor had the hotel built during the first gush of silver from his holes, had supervised the details in both of the bars. This is a drinking man's dream of heaven. Inlaid panels of ebony and oak, cherry wood on the bar top, enamel spittoons with Chinese designs, gleaming brass and silver metalwork, and a dozen cut glass chandeliers hanging overhead. A bartender in sleeve garters is polishing glasses, feigning indifference to the negotiations.
"Gentlemen," says Niles, "are we agreed on the referee?"
"It's Reddy's Hall," says Otto Floto. "He wants to run the bout."
"No objection," says Masterson.
He sits back on the stool, looking at the pistol held in his lap. He turns to Floto.
"Your man," he says, pointing to the sleeper at the bar. "Chief Rain in the Face?"
"He'll be fined for 12 if we tell him." Niles interrupts. "The Blonder brothers specified 10.
"The Blonders can lick my keister," says Masterson. "Do you think he'd put war paint on?"
Otto Floto makes a face.
"We tried that once. It got on the gloves and the fighter's eyes." Headdress, then, when he comes in the ring?"
"I think Harry has one at the paper."
"Little prick probably puts it on when nobody's looking. And your boy here?"
"Brackenridge," Hod calls out.
A name that is neither here nor there, says Masterson. Something Irish. I'm not Irish. And Fireman Jim Flynn is a Dago. What of it?
He fought before under young McGinty, Niles blurts. Niles had promised Hod before that it wouldn't be McGinty, just in case the warrant has traveled from Alaska, but now only puts a finger to his lips to warn him off.
Young McGinty versus Chief
Strong Bear, says the fat man.
It's a match. We advertise a prize of $500, and out of that the fighters get...
Excuse me, says Niles, holding up a hand. If we're talking business... Niles holds a fiver out to Hod. Masterson and Otto Flauto and Niles and even the artist all stare at him as if he shouldn't be there. Hod takes the five and steps to the back of the room.
That's to feed yourself, calls Niles jovially, not for an excursion to Holiday Street.
Hod gives a sleeping man a nudge as he passes on the way to the back door. Lunchtime, buddy. They are out on 18th before Hod realizes that the man is his friend, Big Ten.
If you don't mind, says the Indian, eyeing the five, I haven't eaten in days.
They find a place two blocks up, serving steak and eggs, and settle in.
The fat gink, says Big Ten, is some kind of newspaper writer who also promotes shows. I pulled his coat for a handout over by the opera house, and he pitched this boxing idea.
The Indian doesn't look any smaller than he did in Leadville. Fighting him will be like punching a tree stump.
You know what you're doing in the ring?
Hell no.
What they paying you?
Big Ten shrugs.
The fat man got me a flop for the night, he says. Then it's 20 for showing up, and then the sky's the limit, he says, depending how I handle myself. What about yours?
I think he owes Masterson a lot of money, so this is mostly on the cuff, says Hod. But if I catch him before he can reach a faro table, I might see a few dollars.
Big Ten sighs as the food arrives and they dig in.
There was a sign over that bar, says Big Ten. Said it was against the law to serve an Indian, unless he's been cooked first.
Now, the whole deal sounds like a lot of lumps for short money.
Hod stares out the window at the characters circulating on 18th.
I'd recommend taking a powder, only these people always got an in with the law, if they catch us.
If you promise not to hit too hard, says the Indian, I promise not to fall down too quick.
They linger over their coffee, just thinking, and are on their way back to the Windsor in a light drizzle when a tramp steps up on the sidewalk to block their way.
You fellows spare some change?
The man is swaying a little as he stands, skin and bones, hair wet and wild, looking slightly through rather than at them, like fellas will do when they put the touch on you. Big Ten gives him a nickel and a penny.
That's it, buddy, says the Indian. Now we're as busted as you.
That's white of you, says the tramp, who Hod recognizes from Butte, a mucker on the day gang with a Polish name longer than an ore train.
The man staggers around them, almost falling off the curb.
Always does the heart good, says Big Ten, to see somebody worse off than you are.
On the next block, they see the recruits. There are three of them, two normal-sized and one half-pint kid, standing at stiff attention in the middle of the sidewalk in front of the elite saloon. Our sergeant said he needs to kill his thirst, says the kid, who the others call Runt. Or maybe he just gone in to wound it. One way or the other, we got to stand out here at attention till he comes out.
We're volunteers, says one of the normal-sized ones.
Sure you are, says Big Ten. I can't see how anybody'd pay you to stand out in the rain.
In the army, says Runt, off to battle the Spaniards.
You don't say.
The Runt closes his eyes, then opens them, and begins to spout.
Oh, it's Tommy this, and it's Tommy that, and it's chuck him out, the brute, but it's savior of his country when the guns begin to shoot.
The biggest one looks embarrassed.
He does that. Right out of the blue.
We come up to Pueblo and he latched onto us, says the middle one, but they took us anyway.
The sergeant comes out from the saloon then, a long man with a long mustache drooping off his face. He glares at his volunteers.
Have you been talking to these civilians?
They were asking about enlistment, sir, says the runt, eyes forward, chin tucked in, his scrawny body held rigid, and I was explaining the opportunity.
The sergeant turns to look Hod and Big Ten over.
I got one deserted already and one lost to the clap shack, he says.
You boys ready to take the trip?
The Polish miner wasn't a drinker, Hod remembers. Just a steady, hard-working fella trying to keep grits on his table. He looked like hell, a ghost of a man out there alone in the rain. This is not Hod's war, the plight of the oppressed Cuban, a subject he has barely considered. But there will be 3 squares a day and a chance to see the palm trees, and it won't be Soapy Smith or anyone like him running the deal. Hod, light in the pocket and blackballed from the mines, exchanges a look with the big Indian, who he can tell is also considering the offer.
Where to? Asks Big Ten.
5 blocks over to the armory, says the sergeant, and then on to glory. Hod looks up from the chow line at Camp Alva Adams and can see the flophouse he stayed in the night before he enlisted. The camp is laid out just across the brickyards above Denver City Park, and it is raining, as it has been for weeks now, the volunteers drilling in the mud and eating under a patchwork canvas awning that sags with collected water and promises to collapse under the weight. Runt has been taking bets as to which unit will be soaked when the inevitable occurs. He and Hod and Big Ten and the other late recruits have been reassigned almost daily, landing just this morning from Company G, whose men are mostly from Cripple Creek.
Reinforcements, says a private with a rat-like face as they join the group, waiting with mess kits in the drizzle.
And we ain't even been shot at yet.
We've been sent over to shape up your outfit, says Runt, who is from Pueblo and claims to be a newspaper reporter, and provide a model soldier for you to study.
You'd think they'd have sent a full-size model then.
Runt only comes up to Hod's shoulder, fair game for the wags in every company they've been stuck in.
You figure the bigger the soldier, says Hod, the bigger the target he's gonna make.
The rain comes harder then, and they are soaked by the time their tin plates are weighted with stew, and they can duck under the sagging canvas to sit on wet benches.
Big Ten slaps water off his hat, looks to Hod.
To think we could be in a nice dry variety hall, pounding each other's brains out.
It rains every day in Cuba, the rat-faced soldier tells him.
You been there?
I read all about it in the papers.
That's your tropical climate, says the runt, hot and wet.
The soldier looks at him suspiciously.
How old are you, kid?
Old enough.
The regular army got standard, says the soldier, considering Runt and shaking his head. But us Vols, you ought to see some of the officers.
Any more poop on when they ship us out of here? Asks Hod.
Today he's feeling especially stupid to have signed on, marching and saluting and yes sir and no sir and sleeping in tents in the muck and slop for food. At least in a mine, you've got hours working alone up at the face where the bosses can't ride you.
Depends on how much weight General Hale carries with the high muckety-mucks. Every outfit in the country is trying to be the first to Havana.
What's the hurry? Asks Big Ten, shoveling stew into his mouth.
No hurry, grins the long-faced private, long as they save a couple dagos for me.
After chow, there is battalion drill, sloshing with rifle on shoulder through the mud and the cactus, trying to stride and turn as one man, laborers from the brickworks pausing to watch on their way home. Once the whole battalion is moving, Hod feels better, losing himself in the mass of it, one little part of 400 rifle-toting, cadence-shouting men shifting into rectangles of various sizes or swinging in great flanking maneuvers over and over, the mind numbing with repetition as their boots grow heavy with mud. Since the news of the embarkation at Tampa hit camp, there is a real possibility that they will actually get to use the old trapdoor Springfields they've been given to kill and be killed. So far, they've barely fired a round. The officers more worried about a stray shot hitting the neighbors than the fighting prowess of their troop. If it does come to a real fight, thinks Hod, then hell, the Spanish dons are nothing but bosses, bosses of the cruelest sort. And freeing the poor Cubans from them is a good thing, a noble thing, an American thing to do. There will be breakfast tomorrow, possibly hot, and the next day and the next, his decisions worried out by other men and his hours regulated by trumpet calls. Men like him, homeless, desperate men, are blown about the world like cinders from a locomotive stack, and the army is as good a place for them to end up as any.
So the little kid that you meet, Runt, turns out to be Damon Runyon, who lied about his age and actually got in the Colorado Volunteers and then was bumped out just before they left for San Francisco, snuck on a train, got to the Presidio in San Francisco and just started scouting around the various volunteer regiments until he found one where a couple guys didn't come back from partying in San Francisco. And so he ended up going over there in the Minnesota Volunteers. And he shows up later in the book and even gets to narrate a chapter or two. Thanks, everybody. I'll sign some stuff if you want.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.